Russell and Dialogue Conspiracy. May?
Dialogue Conspiracy, a perspective of events which directly affect world affairs. Your host, research specialist May Brussel.
Good afternoon. Again, another Monday rolls around and time for Dialogue Conspiracy. The format of the shows, for those who haven't listened before, is to take the news of the week and see how it pertains to past political assassinations or conspiracies. I think the show for about 2 years, the name of the program was Dialogue Assassination, and then we changed it to Dialogue Conspiracy, but the bulk of the program usually pertains to political assassinations and murders that are done for the effect of taking over the government or changing the social structure of the United States at home by way of assassination. And two women were in the news today, in the papers today. One was Mrs. Allende, who arrived in Mexico, and the other is Martha Mitchell, who says John has left her. And there's something about those two women that I think is worth remarking. In the interim that the Senate Select Committee was going to take a vacation, Martha Mitchell came forward and made her voice heard again and explained that she wanted to come before the committee and tell them about a document, a file of secret dirty tricks that the her husband and the president were aware of, and she often has said that she could provide information to impeach Richard Nixon, and the Senate Select Committee will not invite her to be a witness before the committee. They, in the interim now, because she hasn't seen this document, they said we'll have Martha Mitchell as a witness. But that was a week ago, and now her husband is saying that he tried to have her confined to a mental institution twice in the last week, and she's under constant care of a psychiatrist to give her supervision. John Mitchell has been moved out of the apartment. He said he had to get out because she was violent, and by violent, he described her as throwing the clothes that he had outside the hall of their apartment, Fifth Avenue. Violence to John Mitchell is nothing, what his clothes being thrown out is nothing compared to what happened to Martha Mitchell at the time of the Watergate arrest out in California. And in the New Realist article, I go into the assaults again, what happened to her, the kidnapping, the assault, the private armies that came in, the injections, the bribery and blackmail involved, keeping her in a safe house, protecting the guilty, promoting Steve King, who assaulted her. He used to be an aide for Senator Gurney of the Senate Select Committee, getting $17,000 a year. Now he's in the Department of Agriculture. He was promoted. None of the men were arrested. She said, why weren't they arrested? I was assaulted. That is what violence is about. The woman was full of bruises. Her hands had stitches. The committee never subpoenaed the medical records. They don't want to know where the stitches were or what happened to that woman, how bad her injuries were. And then she was sedated and flown to New York to the apartment of Mr. Mario, the employer of Donald Nixon. And Martha Mitchell has been accused of being violent. She threw her husband's clothing out on the floor. Martha Mitchell is important because from the moment of the arrest, she knew something. She wanted it to tell. And so long as she's not allowed to tell, it tells you which way this country is going in terms of political future. I think it's a very depressing thing, this constant 24-hour psychiatrist and wanting to commit her to an institution like Dita Baird, of the ITT memos. They want to remove Martha, break her credibility, keep her from appearing before the committee, and that's what is happening now. The other lady is Mrs. Allende, and I also mentioned her husband, Salvador Allende, in the new article. He went before the United Nations in December and accused the United States of altering their elections, of creating economic chaos, wanting civil war, and wanting a military dictatorship. And in the end, he had the courage to go before the UN and name ITT and before the congressional committee. They admitted, William Breaux of the CIA admitted that he paid $1 million to create civil war down in Chile. That was one of the roles. He worked with John J. McCone, former director of the CIA. William Breaux is the same CIA man that was in charge of going through all the records and finding any material pertaining to the Watergate, and they eliminated that before the Justice Department could come in and get those documents. The same ITT that was involved in the Watergate was involved in the Civil War down in Chile. The parallels between the American Civil War, the conflict here, and the Greek military junta have been made on my programs over and over and over again, down the line, the same people that are in power. And if that was too far away in 1967 and you haven't read a book like Death of Democracy by Stephen Russo, then watch Chile, and the way Chile goes is what the president intends to do as he gains his military muscle in the United States, having Mr. William Colby become director of the CIA at a time where he still has 40,000 political prisoners in Vietnam, opposing Thieu, the man in charge of the Phoenix program, lets you know that the covert operation at home and abroad will continue. And his first liberal operation, he's been there since the OSS days, working with Mr. Richard Helms and Alan Dulles' original team. And the first victory in terms of the way they worked for the CIA was the overthrow of Allende this last week. In 1967, Chile didn't have these problems. When Allende came into office, we began to put the squeeze on him. The United States put the squeeze on him. His credit was cut off. The U.S. funded the military offices, and at the time of the coup last week, the people in Washington were aware of it, and the United States Embassy was aware of it. In 1971, we were giving $800,000 in military weapons to the military regime when Allende came to power in 1971, and then when he came in and began to make his land reforms, we increased the military machinery to 5.7 million to give the military government to oppose Allende. In 1972, we gave $12 million, and in 1973, another $12 million to the military. So almost $30 million in the last 3 years of equipment to overthrow Allende, and we gave just a fraction before. Where we gave him credit before for things that they were buying, the minute he put in his reform plans, the credit was dropped off. He had $220 million a year credit in the United States for to conduct the government until he made his reforms, and the credit dropped off from $220 million to $35 million. The CIA has been accused of staging the coup. There you have the format that they can categorically deny this, and that there's no overt evidence. That means we're not leaving any more Pentagon papers around. You can't find a memo that says, let's kill Allende. But most of the nations are pretty aware, and the news is following closely, and nobody believes for a minute, based upon the figures of economic aid and the strangulation of the economy and the motor companies, the large motor companies, the Bank of America, and the large cities strangling him off. I've been watching Allende for a long time, and a lot of optimism. I felt 1972 was a very important year that people would recognize that a man like this could take it before the UN, win a hearing before the congressional committees. They're investigating these large corporations in underdeveloped nations or the overthrow of countries that are still not a political dictatorship. So it's really a dismal picture to see Allende murdered the way he was murdered, and the ITT won again. That's all you can say about that matter. The Senate committee goes back. Their hearings begin next Monday, the 24th, and again, a big cover-up. My new article in The Realist is why is the Senate Watergate Committee functioning as part of the cover-up? They want to cut short their dirty tricks. They don't want you to know about them, and there was an interesting article by Mr. Inouye. This isn't Baker, the apologist for the Republicans, or Mr. Gurney, who's been named three times by various witnesses. This is Mr. Inouye, who said something really startling in terms of dialogue, conspiracy, or assassination. He said he had great fear and doubt that they should go into the dirty tricks. This is what he said this week, because he posed the question, where do dirty tricks end? And where does crime begin? And he said, we already have state laws of libel, larceny, and fraud. And so the federal government, maybe they shouldn't get into crime. And this, he said, if we decide that we go into this area, what do we do about the crime? Now, he doesn't want to touch Arthur Bremer or the shooting of Wallace. He doesn't want to go up to Chappaquiddick and the murder of Mary Jo Kopechne, or the violence against Martha Mitchell, or the murder of Mrs. Hunt, the bag man. And he wants to draw a line between what's improper and unethical, and where the crimes begin. And he's afraid to go to the crimes. Well, I should think the crimes would be what it's all about. So Mr. Inouye has said, and the committee has said, that we will go to Donald Segretti down in Florida, and we'll learn about a letter he wrote against Muskie, and a few dirty letters about Senator Jackson or Humphrey having illegitimate children. And that'll cover the dirty tricks, and then we'll go to the financing. And the whole purpose of the Warren Commission, when all of their work was over and they had a time limit set, was to get new ways to protect a president so he won't be assassinated. And then they began spending millions of dollars on presidential security. And that was not what the Warren Commission was set up to do, and it never went into the question of who killed Lee Harvey Oswald or President John Kennedy. So out of the Watergate, what you're going to get out of the Senate committee is new laws. And you can tell by the way the questioning was going before they went off the air. They would say, have you got any suggestion for a new law to prevent this, Mr. Gordon Strom or Mr. Magruder? What can we tell young people? What laws do you want us to put into effect? Well, the purpose of the Senate Select Committee was not to find new laws to prevent this thing from happening as much as to find out exactly how the election was sabotaged. So now they're going to swing it to the financing and the funding, and they're not going to tell you what the money was for. Now this is a neat little trick. They'll tell you about money, the way money is washed, like the Mexican Houston, Texas operation. They'll tell you how money is passed in cash at various places. They'll tell you how money is raised by corporations through threat and extortion, or money for bribery. The problem with the investigation is not how much they raised or how they hid it, whose safe was in, but why they had to do all that and where it went. Who was paid with all that money that had to be laundered and washed? So I brought in a list of some of the dirty tricks. You know, I have many, many files, over 700 on the Watergate. And I haven't listed all of the dirty tricks, but I brought in a list of a few of the things, and the social implications of these things are so large, but this isn't what they want to go into. They want to go into who raised the money to do it instead of the chain of command, because Donald Segretti said he was one of 50 agents. So when he turns state's evidence, he's not going to name 49 others. But some of the dirty tricks they did, one of them was forgery. The worst was taking John Kennedy's State Department papers, the Pentagon papers, and calling in Hunt into the White House and using a razor blade and ink and forging the Diem papers to make it look like John Kennedy ordered the killing of Diem in Vietnam. They discredited the various candidates by taking their letterheads in at least 20 offices, photographing them, and sending out mail that they didn't intend to go out with messages slurring other candidates to cause anger and forging their names on those and using these letterheads. At the time they were arrested at the Watergate Hotel, James McCord had in his pocket admission slips to the Democratic Convention in Miami, and they were going to reprint, he said, hundreds of these so that more people would show up and this would create a riot, and they duplicate them maybe into the thousands and everyone would get in the hall and certain legitimate people would be left out and others would be left in and they could make a big demonstration inside. They did this letterhead thing down in South Carolina that Billy Graham Day for Richard Nixon, Billy Graham, and ordered the duplication of thousands of tickets so that some couldn't get in and some could. I think the Coliseum had 2,000 people. They printed something like 30,000, outrageous amount. They went all over the town and everyone thought they were going to get in. They rigged the TV polls, the paid ad for Haiphong Harbor, but when it was brought up before the committee how they rigged the TV polls in California in 62 with Mr. Haldeman and Richard Nixon in a lawsuit before the court. Senator Sam Ervin hushed that up and didn't want that in the record. So the same pattern in 62 and now in 72, the Haifa Harbor. And this November group with the rigged polls is a large organization. They're not going into that. They don't want to go into the Las Vegas Mafia Teamsters meetings of Richard Nixon and Air Force One working with the head of the Teamsters Union after being in Palm Springs at the time. Spiro Agnew was there, and Bob Hope, and making deals for a health plan out in California. They don't want to go into that. The stealing of the doctor's records is being taken care of in California, the lawsuit there. The disguises of the hippies, the urinating and defecating in Miami, the paid agents that were doing that, or to embarrass McGovern, or the nude FBI women swimming around in the ponds. I doubt if they'll get into that. The Senator Tidings was running for office, and he lost. He was framed by Charles Colson, who gave information to Life magazine. They did a smear story. I don't think they'll go into those dirty tricks. I'm listing some of the dirty tricks that they're not going to investigate. Where a man lost a seat in the Senate, he has a home in Washington, an office set up, he's running, and they print lies, Charles Colson, and he loses the election, and later they, half apology, you know. The robbery attempt at Hank Greenspun in Las Vegas for the Howard Hughes game plan, written out plans to arrange the election for Richard Nixon and then control him from then on. I don't know if they'll go into those. McCloskey's mail was diverted. Mr. Baldwin was never called as an agent. He's another one who got off because he was at the Howard Johnson Hotel across from the Watergate, and Alfred Baldwin was never used as a witness. He's an ex-FBI man and a escort also for Martha Mitchell, and carried Fred LaRue's gun around on airplanes with Martha Mitchell. He helped divert McCloskey's mail in California. He won't be called. The fake riots and demonstrations at the time J. Edgar Hoover died, and the Cubans brought up from Miami, Bernard Barker and Martinez Gonzalez, and they brought in a whole team and fake these riots to discredit people who would defame the name of J. Edgar Hoover, when this team actually was saying that he was senile, they sneaked things out of the FBI office. They were the ones that were working against J. Edgar Hoover, that secret team. And they wanted Ellsberg and the hippies to look like they didn't love J. Edgar Hoover when they had knifed him in the back and had arranged his demise, and then they staged this thing up front, these fake riots. The Muskie offices were robbed of stationery and forged. As I said, the Annenberg letter was written by Charles Colson. It's a letter that came from England praising Charles Colson, written by Colson, praising Nixon, written for the State Department on their stationery, sent out all over to government heads, and telling them what a fine person Richard Nixon was, and he's the president who could bring us into this great era of peace and prosperity, which we're all enjoying now. The Health Education and Welfare Group also had memos written by Charles Colson praising the domestic budget, and there's a lawsuit about that, but it's being hushed up, and every department was given a promotion by the same advertising agency, the November Group, to show what a good situation, healthy climate Richard Nixon had for the elections. He was setting the whole emotional scene for people to be secure that every department that he had was working to their very fullest. And these were ads paid by these provocateurs that went in that belonged to organizations that didn't exist, from funds that they didn't know where they came from, praising government agencies. The San Jose provocateurs will not be looked into. Congressman Edwards has been asking them to look into that. Haldeman was in San Jose just before Richard Nixon appeared. The rock throwing didn't actually take place. There was a lawsuit about that, claiming the innocence of the people who were accused of being involved. They said they were provocateurs, and when the Watergate broke, they asked for that to be investigated. That isn't going to be investigated. Humphrey's drunk driving charges, Donald Segretti was framing him with fake letters, and I don't know how much of that. The Muskie letter and the racial slurs up in New Hampshire, Donald Segretti is going to take those charges in Florida. That is one of the few things. Now, the aircraft tower controls in Chicago, Florida, and Oregon were all tampered with when planes of candidates arrived. One with Henry Jackson, Florida, the lights went out on the field before he landed. Planes landed in Salem, Oregon, when they were supposed to land in Portland. All these people inconvenienced, which means that maybe 1,000 people are going to a rally, they have tickets, the man doesn't show up. I remember when McGovern went to San Francisco, and he was supposed to speak to a large group in San Francisco. He had a good following. And they moved the meeting down to Fisherman's Wharf, and 5 people were there. It was really pathetic, you know, and they were talking about it on KGO, and somebody called into Salinger and said, look, you're managing that guy's campaign. There's 5 people there. And I think Jim Dunbar said, you know, you can have our station. You can reach 100,000 people. Why don't you use our radio program? And he said, Salinger, you've been accused of sabotaging the McGovern campaign to leave it ready for Ted Kennedy. Are you the people that are hurting him? But there's so much confusion, and these planes were brought down in the wrong cities. The control towers were controlled, and the Chicago airplane tower was controlled at the time. This is Hunt's airplane went down through manipulation on the airplane, also in the control tower. So that's 3 cities there, Chicago, Florida, and Oregon. And how many more? The question is how many more airport towers are in Philly where you can control a situation, whether an airplane comes in without lights, or whether they're told to go on to the next place they can't land on the field where they actually could have landed. The switchboards at the hotels. I have files of people in Miami at the time of the convention, and in San Diego at the Beverly Hills Hotel in California. Switchboard operators not giving messages, getting the messages mixed up. Wiretapping. Conspiracy lawyers, Arthur Kinnoy, 23 conversations were wiretapped. He was representing a case in Chicago. The FBI breaking into the underground press around the country at 8 newspapers. They had records of breaking into the press of 8 underground newspapers. There were many call girls hired in Miami, in addition to the ones that Liddy talked about. And there was an article last week that when Senator Muskie was up in New Hampshire giving his famous speech, that an agent has said he gave LSD in his drink or food before he appeared in public, and one reason for his crying is that they give him LSD. And there are Alan Cranston, they're not going into the gemstone story of Alan Cranston and the girl that got LSD, and he was given a stiff fine, and there was a long trial in trying to embarrass Senator Cranston. The Chilean embassy was broken in April 71 and May 72 by the same Watergate team that was out of the Ellsberg case. They flew from California to New York City, and the Senate committee isn't going to go into breaking into these embassies. The Brookings Institute, they're not going to continue. They have mentioned these things. Witnesses, the attempted firebombing of the Brookings Institute, but the Senate Select Committee doesn't go into the chain of command like they did earlier. You see, they broke the chain of command too easily through the last Senate hearings, where the president has a lawyer named Herbert Kalmbach, and he goes around raising money from people that want Richard Nixon in power, and then Kalmbach meets with Mr. Caulfield of the Treasury Department, and Mr. Caulfield lines up Anthony Lapwitz, who works with the New York Police Department and has access all of their files on radicals and minority people, and the team, then Caulfield and Lapwitz can send out their chain of command, and they were up at Chappaquiddick, they were involved in the Arthur Brammer situation. There's evidence that Caulfield with a New York accent, Lapwitz rather, could have been the man that was Arthur Brammer. This hasn't been investigated. But too much came out at the first set of hearings. They had a set of people they were going to call as witnesses. And then one witness broke up another story about the tapes when John Dean was on, and he mentioned that the story of Richard Nixon going to the window and mumbling about Colson. He thought the room was bugged. That brought up the situation about the president's room being bugged and the tapes. And when James McCord said he got these threats on his life, that he should shut up and not talk, he should plead guilty, that brought in, who had the New York accent? That brought in Mr. Caulfield and Mr. Lapwitz. And too many things opened up when Mr. Lapwitz was on the stand. Senator Weicker said, what were the other jobs you did for these men? Because he'd done 32 jobs. And one of them was a $100,000 job in 69 that involved the Chappaquiddick affair. So Sam Irvin said, well, we can't go into those now. We don't have time. He said, we'll be doing this thing down till Gabriel's horn stops blowing, and he gave one of his famous quotations, and everyone laughed. So the question is, will Lasswitz be back to tell you about the 32 things that he did for this administration? Everybody was laughing at him, and he's the most serious man of all. Now, Mayor Alyota in San Francisco had a lawsuit placed against him, and he said the same people involved in the Watergate were the ones that he thought framed him. He mentioned John Mitchell and the Assistant Attorney General Peterson and Mr. Hundley, who's John Mitchell's attorney, and John Ehrlichman and A. Jill Crow, and he said they had access to things that nobody else would have, like FBI files or criminal intelligence and the LA Police Department, immigration services. They utilized every government agency to come down on him. So he wanted that investigated, and they said, no, we won't go into that. The phony letters of the sex habits of Muskie and Humphrey, that's fairly safe they'll go into that. The Dan Rather burglary, I have a list of about 15 burglaries and wiretaps, but these all go into the category of dirty tricks. So Senator Inouye says, well, we can't go into the dirty tricks because where do they leave off in criminal matters begin? And I didn't know that they weren't supposed to go into criminal matters. Now, the argument is that we'll leave it to the courts, which Richard Nixon wants and Senator Baker, is ridiculous because the courts would never have the Ellsberg case, they'd never have the Houston Mexican transaction, the money washing, they wouldn't have the Vesco case. If we had left it to the Justice Department, the courts wouldn't have any of these cases, the indictment of Ehrlichman out in California and A. Jill Crow and Young. And this is what they don't want the second half. You see, they have a big team from the National Security Council already named in the California suit when you get A. Jill Young, and they have backups that will take their place for sure in the White House. But when you begin to expose Henry Kissinger's aides working with the Domestic Security Council to send somebody out to get Ellsberg, you know, they don't want any more exposed. They can only go so far, and they don't want to go into the really heavy crime, so they're going to stick with putting bubble gum in an ashtray or something and calling that a dirty trick. So if you want to see the chain of command, which they don't want us to do, I suggest that write a letter this week to the Senate Select Committee on Campaign Practices for 1972, because there's a lot of committees in Washington, and write another letter this week. I give you one each week to write, but this is a good one, and say, we don't want to be shortchanged on the dirty tricks, that this is the most important part of the investigation, and this is the part the Democrats don't want, because the Democrats had their own dirty tricks. And this is why there's so much support to hush the dirty trick department, because the Democrats begin to get involved in the 68, the killing of Bobby Kennedy that helped Richard Nixon along. They're registered Democrats, like Donald Segretti is a registered Democrat. He's a Republican provocateur. So if they go too far, the Republican provocateur who's a registered Democrat is going to bring out of the woods all the Salingers and Schlesingers and the people around McGovern and all the real spies that have been there for 15, 20 years that have made the Democratic Party completely shattered. That's what they wanted to do. That's what they achieved. And they don't want the chain of command broken in front of the television for people to see at home. Now another chain of subject, James Earl Ray, who the alleged assassin of Martin Luther King, has another court case coming up. And this court case is October the 9th in 2 weeks. And the district attorney in Memphis, Tennessee, has said that as far as he's concerned, the case is closed, despite the fact that James Earl Ray says he's not the killer. He said nobody's come forward for 5 years or offered any information. Well, the reason nothing comes forward is that every time you go and offer information, they turn it away or don't tell anybody it was turned in, so they can say they don't have information. I cut out an article this last week. I thought I was going to make $10,000, which I could use. It was a $10,000 reward in the Stanford slaying of this David Levine. And I called up, I thought, well, maybe there's some help because the San Jose police and Sheriff's Department are in on those two murders up in, well, they're in on a lot of murders, but these campus murders, they are hiding the conspiracies, and they had the assassin of this Perloff girl, and they let her go. And I think the same man who did that murder is very much involved down the campus. It was near the library again. I have his name and address in Palo Alto. Somebody came and told me how he was brought in and let go. And, you know, Charles Vance and his whole team of chicks and men and everybody were brought in from Spahn Ranch and went to the L.A. Sheriff Department of Peter Pitches, and he let them go to Barker Ranch, where they weren't supposed to be arrested. They were brought in and arrested after those massacres in California a few years ago. But I thought, well, I'll trust the Palo Alto police, and spoke to them on campus twice, and they said they'd call back this week, but they didn't call back. Because the reward is out, but if you offer them names to look into, or you have suggestions of places, and you give the background of that person, and I gave a really good background of some heavy arson in San Francisco, this person I believe is involved in, and these two murders, and they don't call back because they say they want to know. But if you get close to what's happening, they don't want to know. It's like the Santa Cruz murders, where a man saw a long bit of hair coming out of the trunk of a car, and he calls the sheriff's department and the police department, and that's the night that a witness for a drug case was being carted off and cut up to little pieces, and part of her was dropped down in Big Sur, that Cynthia Ann Schell. Well, there was no record later that this man ever turned in this information. He waited to see, and they said, well, we lost this information. We don't know where that was later when the body showed up. And there was a reason why they didn't want to have that information, because they were carting her away and cutting her up, and you weren't supposed to know why they were doing it, and the effect was the scare in the community, and everybody bought guns, and nobody picks up hitchhikers, and they lost their witness for a framed drug case, so they could say we caught a real big drug dealer who was a young student who'd been in peace demonstrations in Santa Cruz and wanted to prove his innocence. And this particular girl that was murdered was at the police department with a provocateur that set him up, and he had bragged about it. So she was to appear at the trial, and she was murdered. And they brought her, she was murdered at the time. There's a whole series there at Santa Cruz. But the Mullen series that he's claimed he's done, and I don't believe he's done all of those either. Cynthia Schell is not among those. And that's another private murder. And the others were taking place at the same time, so that was very nicely tucked away and hidden. Well, back to James Earl Ray and the planted evidence, he says, the FBI down there says that we have no evidence in 5 years. But if you turn in evidence, they destroy it or kill the witnesses. So James Earl Ray in October is going to have another chance. Now, what he said was that he left the room, that he did have a gun. He was told to buy a gun, and it was in the room, and it had his fingerprint. But he met a man named Raul, R-A-U-O-U-L, and they talked about gun running in South America, and he left the rooming house, and he claims that Raul was involved in the murder of Martin Luther King. Now, there's a parallel, or what we call a coincidence, running through all these different shows that I do, and when Virgilio Gonzalez was arrested at the Watergate Hotel, his alias was Raul, R-A-O-U-L, Godot, the same Raul, and another man, Mr. Frank Sturgis, arrested at the Watergate Hotel, admitted this week that in 1968, he's being indicted, they used a car robber, a cover-up for theft, taking automobiles from Miami to Mexico City, and this was a cover-up for clandestine operations. And Frank Sturgis has been running from Miami to Mexico as a cover-up with the auto theft. So Raul could be doing his gun running to South America, because we know that Sturgis and Howard Hunt and Martinez and Gonzalez had worked as a team since 1960 in and out of South America and Mexico. And the contact man, Raul, had sent James Earl Ray to Mexico two times, to Puerto Vallarta, and told him he was doing missions for them. And he claims that Raul is the man that was involved. So it is a coincidence at Watergate that one of the defendants signed into the police as Raul. Another coincidence in the news this week, since we met, because we always have a lot of these coincidences, is that when Lee Harvey Oswald went to Mexico City, he sat on a bus, and everybody had a registration number. His number was FM24085. It was a Mexican tourist agency number. The man that sat with him, that got the bus number right next to him, FM24084, went by the name of William Gaudet, G-A-U-D-E-T, an agent for the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, that's an interesting little coincidence, because a Mr. Gaudet was going to be the patsy if Richard Nixon was killed in New Orleans. They had him selected, and a tip-off woman that said, yeah, it was Godet that said he was going to kill Richard Nixon, turned out to be a female agent of the Ku Klux Klan. We had a tip-off at the John Kennedy assassination when somebody, a priest from Alabama, said the gun came from Klein's in Chicago. A member of the Klan was giving the tip-off about Godet. Godet happened to be in New Mexico, but had he been killed and he didn't have enough people around him, his wife and children, to verify that he had been there and not in New Orleans, they could say he fled New Orleans and was killed in New Mexico fleeing the scene of the crime. A Secret Service agent tipped off the assassination attempt. A lot of people don't take it seriously. The next conspiracy newsletter I'm doing is on all of the facts, about 20 of them, to back up the information that there was a serious assassination attempt on Richard Nixon, and by a fluke, a Secret Service agent turned it in, just like Lee Harvey Oswald had called the FBI 2 days before John Kennedy was killed and said, what's happening here? Kennedy's going to be killed here. Well, I believe that Godet was the patsy, and now it's interesting that this same name, I don't know if it's the same person or not, but he traveled on the bus with Lee Harvey Oswald, and it's an interesting coincidence, it's an unusual name, that he was an agent of the Central Intelligence Agency sitting with him on the bus. Speaking of the Nixon assassination, Ramparts magazine, this just came out this last week, has four really good articles in them, one after the other. It's just packed with information, and for those of you that listen to the show or take cassettes, you'll really like these issues. One's called The Strange Tale of the Secret Army Organization, and it's by Richard Propkind from the University of Southern California. He wrote the book, The Second Oswald, and Lewis Packwood helped Propkind write this article. And it's a good article on the Secret Army down in San Diego and the connections of Segretti, Donald Segretti, and Dwight Chapin on the assassination, the plans to assassinate Richard Nixon in San Diego. And Lewis Packwood has the tapes of the plans to assassinate Richard Nixon. And this article goes into the meeting place of Segretti and Dwight Chapin down in San Diego preceding the San Diego plan. This was before it was moved to Miami. But it goes into the meeting place, and the tapes do exist on the assassination plan. So you have Dwight Chapin, the appointment secretary of the White House, meeting with Donald Segretti, and this again involves the FBI working with the Secret Army Organization, and I think it's one small section of a whole operation. It's a good article. It has a lot of detail, so get it and read it. They also have another article in the Ramparts on C. Arnold Smith and the San Diego Connection. And this goes into Richard Nixon's friend, Arnold Smith, who began supporting him. He worked for the Bank of America, and he was a member of the Lincoln Club, that secret group that started Richard Nixon's career when he was still in Navy intelligence. And see, Arnold Smith is finally in trouble with the law and the Internal Revenue, with the FBI, and he claims that because the Watergate is coming down, that the government is going to come. And they put a $22 million lien on his taxes, so you can imagine what his profits were. That was a 69 thing. And he claimed this year, because of Watergate, everyone wants to get even with Richard Nixon's friends. But the truth is that before the Watergate, nobody could take these cases to court. They had all the evidence on C. Arnold Smith before to take him to court on many, many charges. And there's some excellent articles out on C. Arnold Smith's connections to organized crime, the syndicate, the mafia, and it's a good article. That also is in Ramparts. The New York Times and Washington Post had a long article on C. Arnold Smith this week, which was excellent, and one of the things that was really important, he has an attorney by the name of Donnelly, and Donnelly not only represents C. Arnold Smith with all of his mafia connections, but he lived at the Desert Inn Hotel in Las Vegas from 1962 to 1968 and was their accountant. He's in charge, he's representing clients who are in charge of taking the skimming money from Mexico to Switzerland and the Bahamas. But he was an attorney for the Desert Inn in charge of the bookkeeping there. Well, Donnelly happens to be from the law firm that John Mitchell and Richard Nixon represented, of Mudge and Rose and Guthrie. John Mitchell and Nixon, and that is really interesting when you realize that Richard Nixon law partner was at the Desert Inn, because when I cross-filed my work on the John Kennedy assassination, Jack Ruby made a trip to the Desert Inn just 2 weeks before he shot Lee Harvey Oswald, and it seems that the lawyer, Nixon's lawyer and Mitchell's lawyer, the whole team, were very heavily involved with two Las Vegas hotels that of Howard Hughes came and bought over. The purpose of moving in there was to take the skimming money and put it into the more military establishment and tie off the cultural, the mafia, the Italian group, and the subculture. I call them the subculture in their minds, the babble of, I call them the white Christian ITT. Howard Hughes want to strangle the mafia after the 72 elections and get tough on the organized crime so they could take over from them. You can't have too many powers at one time. And the move of Hughes to take over was all synchronized and to get out the other gang. And Mitchell moved in there, his lawyer and Nixon's lawyer. And then he also represents the San Diego groups, the Watergate, it's not the Watergate, the Westgate development. And this article, the one on T. Arnold, just goes into San Diego connections and all of his problems and his tackling, and that's in the Ramparts. Then the Ramparts had another article, they have four, one on the politics of police reform, and this goes into the Office of Law Enforcement, and this is by Andrew Kopkin, who's also done a lot of work on conspiracies and assassinations, and it goes into the police state and Mr. Kelly, the new head of the FBI and the computerized police department. It's kind of scary to read these all four in one night, I'll tell you. And about the CIA helping setting up the law enforcement in each individual city. And this, again, was the reason for having to remove J. Edgar Hoover at this time, to take control of the FBI and computerize us into the Defense Intelligence Agency and the CIA. And this is another article, the third one. That is a heavy third article in the Ramparts. And would you believe, if you don't get your money's worth, they have a fourth called the Watergate and the World of CIA, by Fletcher Prouty, another man who's doing a lot of work into political assassinations and research and revealing his work with the Central Intelligence Agency. And this whole issue of Ramparts looks like a rundown of Mae Bressel conspiracy newsletter, the things we talk about every week. And it begins by saying, explosive as the Watergate revelations have been, no disclosure has been more ominous than the 1970 domestic intelligence plan attributed to the pen of Tom Charles Houston. The plan, and it goes into electronic surveillance and so forth. And what Fletcher Prouty was saying, and he worked many years with these people, with Dulles, McCord, and Oswald, he knows the whole team, was saying that Tom Charles Houston did not write that plan, the Frankenstein monster. It was put out by the military, and he only presented it. Well, in the new conspiracy newsletter, I have down one of the witnesses to be called before the committee that they won't have. One was Martha Mitchell, the other was Lewis Tacklin, one is William Sullivan of the FBI Division 5, and the other is Tom Charles Houston. Because I read very carefully the 1970 plans, and there is no reason to believe that Tom Charles Houston could ever write such a document. He's got all the instructions and orders for Richard Nixon, and the way it reads, there's no way that this lawyer from Indiana, from YAF, Young Americans for Freedom, could write that document. That had to be written by the Pentagon. It had to be written by the intelligence agencies. Well, Prouty works inside. I deducted from the way it was written that it was impossible to have been done by Mr. Houston. But this is a man, Fletcher Prouty, who's worked inside the system and says it was written by Melvin Laird and the Pentagon, and he gives his reasons. And that's the fourth article in Ramparts. So those of you who listen to the show, get the new Ramparts. There's a picture of Spiro Agnew, Richard Nixon on it, and you'll get a rundown of a lot of the things we've been talking about. The San Diego plan, the plans to assassinate Richard Nixon, the police state, the CIA and the Watergate, and C. Arnold Smith. It covers the whole era in its own way, and the four articles are excellent. Last week we talked about the Supreme Court and pornography and the way that Richard Nixon decided to take the minority view of Reverend Hill in California, funded by LEAA, to break pornography, the bookstores and magazines. I read that all of Idaho has gone clean as of today. there are no Playboys or anything, one state after the other will fall down, and they'll send these records to the next place, and they're clearing the newsstands, all movies and books, the libraries. Idaho went clean. Well, there was a memo the next day after I did my radio show. There was a article, Dear Abby. Somebody wrote to Dear Abby on viewing the X film, and her opinion in one of her columns was that let them have them, that you shouldn't have police squads. It'll fade away of its own natural death, and if people want to see it, they should. And a man wrote her a letter, a very vicious letter, and I'm reading one sentence from it. He said, there are a lot of people whose minds never get above their waist, and these movies only encourage more of that attitude. When it comes to trying to stop this kind of film, I believe they should shoot the people who exhibit the film. And who signs it? William Loeb, publisher. The same man who discredited Muskie, who discredited Eagleton, who is very much part of the political scene of Richard Nixon's career. William Loeb is the publisher who sends a letter to Dear Abby that the men who show these films should be killed. The White House enemy list, these are the things that we learned in the first part of the hearing. The memos brought out their vernacular, the way they talk, and the quotations, some of them are now famous, some we forget, but to go along with William Loeb, he says the people should be killed. We think of Ehrlichman referring to Patrick Gray and let him twist slowly in the wind. And John Mitchell said about Liddy, I think we should have drawn the group of Watergate scoundrels on the White House lawn and have them shot. And John Dean's recommendation is we'll study all we can and use every piece of the federal machinery to screw our political enemies. And Charles Colson gave orders to everyone at the White House, you know, be strict and stern and do what you have to do, and I'd walk over my grandmother if necessary. Fred LaRue beat him one. He shot his own father to show his loyalty. And Mr. Haldeman and Alexander Butterfield were criticizing Ernest Fitzgerald of the Pentagon because the cost overrun was so outrageous on the C-51, and they said we should let him bleed for a while. And Charles Colson has a memo that came out this last week talking about, he made a conversation with Hunt about Ellsberg after the Pentagon Papers were stolen, and he said we should go down the line and nail that guy cold. So that's the language. This is the team that we're working with, and when they talk this way, and we don't want to know at the Senate hearings how their money is coming in or how they're spending. What we really want to know is how many more dirty tricks there are and what else they plan and who else wasn't exposed that could be exposed if they went into the dirty trick. Now, there's an excellent book. Again, we're running short of time. I just have about 4 minutes, and there's no point going too deeply into this book because I think people who listen to this show should buy the book, support the author. The funds are going into a legal case. The name of the book is The Truth About Kent State. I just got it this week. It's written by Peter Davis. They have them at the Thunderbird in Carmel. The Thunderbird is carrying the realist, too. If you're in the area here and up at Santa Cruz, you'll have to find a bookstore that carries these matters up there. But there's The Truth About Kent State, Peter Davis. And there's 70 photographs. And the important thing about this is that private investigators have to do the work that the Justice Department will not do on criminal conspiracy cases. They have to get their own thing together. A Methodist church group and a group of citizens worked for 3 years to come to conclusions about what happened, and then they got out a book, and then they present it to the Justice Department. They say, now what are you going to do with this evidence? And now they have to go into the killings at Kent State. And what these 70 pictures show, a Methodist church helped them get this out, is number one, the guardsmen were at no danger at any time. They said they had to shoot. The students were attacking them. There isn't one photograph that shows anybody near them. They were hundreds of feet away, and they were going the other direction, and over down a hill, and the guardsmen were coming up, and no one was in danger, not a guardsman. What it showed was that there was a prearranged signal, that the guardsmen all went in a huddle. There's a photograph of them in a football type of huddle. They all broke, took their gun, and aimed. And these are really sad pictures of students lying there, 13 shot, 4 killed, blood pouring down the sidewalk. What it showed, they came to the conclusion that it was a predetermined target, not random. There were certain students that they wanted. They shot 13, but there were 4 that they wanted. The next thing it showed was that the cover-up followed exactly like the Watergate follow-up. They had fabrications that were contrived, and they used the cover-up and fell for that and said, we don't have to have a grand jury investigation of this. It's a perfectly legitimate thing that guards were attacked, and they had to shoot the crowd, and the photographs will prove otherwise. The grand jury in Ohio had a hearing, not a federal grand jury, this is Ohio, and they indicted 25 students for being responsible for the riot, and not one guardsman was indicted. And the Justice Department said, therefore, the case is closed. This particular man who did the research is an insurance salesman. He's new in this country. He was a refugee. He believed in America. He lived in the town, and he began to hear people talking about the violence, and he wanted to do something and collected his evidence, and the evidence is overwhelming. To go into this thing and open it up. And a man who got out of Orangeburg, South Carolina, he was in jail where students were shot just before Kent State, is out of jail now, and the Civil Liberties Union is going into that. And once more, private citizens will find out how the students were killed and the riots caused down there. Well, the time is running out. It's been 45 minutes, and that's the end of Dialogue Conspiracy. Write to the Senate Select Committee and tell them we want to know the dirty tricks, because that's what it's all about, and the whole election was a dirty trick. And I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy, featuring research specialist Mae Bruckle.